Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. A few years after quitting his job to follow an ill-advised dream to become a guide on the Colorado River, writer Kevin Fidarko was approached by his best friend, National Geographic photographer Pete McBride, with a vision as bold as it was harebrained. Together, they would embark on an end-to-end traverse of the Grand Canyon, a journey that McBride promised would be a walk in the park. Against his better judgment, Fidarko agreed to the scheme, unaware that the small cluster of experts who had completed the crossing billed it as the toughest hike in the world. The ensuing ordeal, which lasted more than a year, revealed a place that was deeper, richer, and far more complex than any of the two men had imagined. And we'll talk with Kevin Fidarko about his new book, called A Walk in the Park, following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. A few years after quitting his job to follow an ill-advised dream of becoming a guide on the Colorado River, Kevin Fidarko was approached by his best friend, National Geographic photographer Pete McBride, with a vision as bold as it was harebrained. Together, they would embark on an end-to-end traverse of the Grand Canyon, a journey that McBride promised would be a walk in the park. And against his better judgment, Fidarko agreed to the scheme, unaware that the small cluster of experts who had completed the crossing billed it as the toughest hike in the world. And the ensuing ordeal, which lasted more than a year, revealed a place that was deeper, richer, and far more complex than anything the two men had imagined, and came within a hair's breadth of killing them both. Kevin Fidarko has spent the last 20 years writing about conservation, exploration, and the Grand Canyon. His writing has appeared in the National Geographic, New York Times, Esquire, among other publications. He lives in Flagstaff, Arizona. He's author, previously the bestseller, The Emerald Mile. Kevin Fidarko, thanks for coming on the show.
Tom, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Fascination with the Grand Canyon, obviously. Emerald Mile also is a trip through the Grand Canyon, right?
It is, although that's a historic event that took place, you know, more than 30 years ago. But yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
That's a fast trip through the canyon, right? High tide and hair raising in its own way. You're friends with Pete McBride, I guess friends for a long time. Have you done things like this? He just comes to you and says, "Hey, let's do this," and off you go.
You know, unfortunately, we have a long history of magazine assignments that have taken us all over the world over the past 25 years. And most of them hold one thing in common, which is Pete coming up with an incredibly bad idea and talking me into it. And the ensuing debacle is usually what forms the frame of the story that we end up writing after that. So there's a whole litany of these disasters that have occurred, but the one that he proposed that we do in the Grand Canyon was by far the worst of them all.
So 750 miles through, I guess, the full length of the canyon, you can't walk on the rim. I guess that's part of the rules.
You need to stay beneath the rim, and this is a landscape that is not designed for moving laterally on foot. There are, in addition to the main stem canyon itself, there are approximately 640 tributary canyons that come in from either side and that require extensive detouring. There's so much detouring that, you know, the Colorado River takes about 277 miles to get from the eastern end of Grand Canyon at what we call Lee's Ferry all the way to the western terminus of the canyon at the Grand Wash Cliffs. But if you're on foot and walking into and out of all those side canyons, that's how the mileage jacks up to 750 miles.
And there's only, a few miles of actual trail, right? No real trails down there.
That's the other thing that Pete failed to mention. There's no trail that will take you from one end to the other across the length of, you know, what is the second most visited of all of our national parks in America and probably the most iconic of them all. There are some wonderful trails, many of which will take you from the rim down to the river, but there's only about 15% of the terrain on the south side of the canyon is covered by trails. And if you're on the north side of the canyon, that number drops to about 5% of the terrain covered by trails.
So you guys has, as you described it, fast-talked a group of experienced hikers. Ultra-hikers, what do they call themselves?
They're long-distance. Extreme hikers, yes.
Mm-hmm. And yes. So you'd fast-talked your way onto this onto this team. The first part of the book is high comedy. This is great stuff. Pete, I guess, start sending gear to your, having it sent to your house, and you're supposed to unpack it and test it, right?
I'm embarrassed to say that was my job. My job was to make sure that all the gear was unpacked and properly arranged and in good working order. And, you know, there were just a whole series of important tasks, napping, mowing the lawn, watching TV at night. And I just wasn't able to get to everything by the time our departure date arrived. And so we showed up at our first camp, where we were meeting this crew of highly experienced hikers, and spent several hours unboxing all of our gear in the dark and trying to put it together.
Yeah, I love that. That passage, you know, about you had other important things to do, like napping. That's totally me. But, you know, my wife gets after me. Why don't you get onto this stuff? But it's still, I'd expect, before I got to that passage, I'd fully expected you would have gotten to it before you actually drove out in the dark to the, I guess, the rim of the canyon. But no, that you started unpacking the boxes right then.
It's kind of a classic thing. It's not unusual for people to find themselves in a predicament like that at the beginning of a big trip, but this was taken to a new level, I think. I don't know that any two hikers had ever in the history of Grand Canyon hiking appeared on the east rim of the Grand Canyon so unprepared as the two of us.
Now, these experienced hikers, they were curious, came over. That I don't know what they must have thought. I guess you talked to them later to know what they thought. And probably, why are we taking these guys with us?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question, and it boils down to the fact that, you know, there's a very small but incredibly passionate community of people who are deeply connected to this park and this landscape, and they had agreed to allow us to accompany them on what was supposed to be the first leg of our adventure, mainly because they were aware that National Geographic was doing a story. And part of the reason for that story was to showcase and throw a spotlight on some development threats that loom over the canyon and that threaten the integrity and the future of the park itself. And so they agreed to help us and to allow us to accompany them, primarily because they wanted the larger story of the canyon to be told. Mm-hmm. They were very, very nice people, but it was more than just simply altruism. It was a dedication to the canyon that was their motivation.
So these folks, is that, I guess, to test themselves? That's one reason they're doing this. Another reason they love the canyon? Is that why they're doing it?
You know, that's another good question, the motivation. Why do something that is so long and so difficult and takes so many years to prepare for? I mean, these four hikers had been preparing for the past 4 or 5 years by training on a series of smaller hikes, by getting their gear and their nutrition programs dialed in and understanding the landscape and the maps and the complexity of all of it. And I think the reason really has to do with the mystery and the complexity and the power of the Grand Canyon. This is a chasm that, you know, it's a mile deep chasm with a river running along the bottom of it. But by virtue of the fact that there aren't any trails connecting one end to the other, the backcountry inside Grand Canyon National Park can feel almost completely untrammeled. And it is filled with all kinds of tiny little pockets of wonder where there are treasures and sites that people standing on the rim or people going on a boat trip along the bottom of the canyon never, ever get to see. Hidden grottos with still water, turquoise waterfalls coming out of the sides of cliffs, wonderful oases of trees and birds and other green plants. And you encounter these things only if you make the commitment to move into this place and kind of explore it on foot. And that was part of, I think, what really drove these people to embark on something so ambitious.
You talk about pack discipline these fellows had, you guys didn't have at that point. So no magazine or book, nothing extra, everything ultra light, because you're going to have to, you know, some passages here pack in water and food. And then I just want to read this part. It wasn't that they didn't covet those things, but they had cast away everything except what mattered for their survival, testing how well they understood the difference between what they merely wanted and what they'd actually need. A distinct that demanded a measure of ruthlessness, and those choices said something about the canyon, too, how in forcing you to pare down your dunnage, this landscape would pare you down, too. And you go on to talk about how that hike's first leg would strip you and Pete, both of you, down to bedrock. I imagine it changed you in ways maybe you didn't even anticipate.
It did change us in many ways we didn't anticipate, particularly because, you know, Tom, this is a landscape that both Pete and I thought that we knew. I mean, I had written an entire book on the subculture of whitewater boating in the Grand Canyon. I had spent many years as a river guide. I thought that this was a landscape that I had kind of mastered. And it's an important element of our journey to mention this, because I think we went into this, we embarked on it with a level of arrogance that is inappropriate to Grand Canyon. It's a landscape that is extreme and brutal and austere, like many desert landscapes. And it requires not just a level of commitment, but a level of humility in order to kind of move through it. And there's a physical manifestation of that you just touched on. You know, there's an imperative to pare down the weight that you're carrying to the absolute minimum. You cannot bring, 1 or 2 ounces more than what you absolutely need. And this is to ensure that you will be able to carry the water that will enable you to survive as you move from one small pocket of water to the next across that matrix of cliffs and ledges that stretch between the rims of the canyon and the edges of the river. But there's also an abstract and metaphysical dimension to it as well. There's a minimalism to the landscape, and to the extent that the canyon has been bared by rock, by weather and erosion and wind, and stripped down to its bones. And that's exactly what this landscape does to human beings who move through it. And so by the end of the journey, Pete and I had, I think, a level of humbleness and humility that was very different from the mindset with which we started.
I want to bring this to the end of the book, but I want to bring this forward, and this won't give away any plot points. But you say you wrote it, the book, in the hope that people might one day rise to the defense of the canyon. We'll get into talking about some of the threats, including, you know, tourism and development, and twinned with a fervent wish for the landscape itself to remain untrammeled. And you go on to say this book is in no way intended to serve as an invitation for readers to rush out to the canyon's backcountry, nor is it meant to offer a guide to navigating that terrain. Indeed, it's emphatically the opposite. You don't want people, I mean, there are dangers, right? But you don't want the bottom of the canyon to be crowded.
No, I think one of the hallmarks of Grand Canyon's backcountry is the fact that it is still so remote, so isolated, so little used. And one of the things I wrestled with when I was writing this book and putting it together was the fear that telling a story like this might encourage the very thing that I was hoping to prevent, and kind of open the gates or serve as an invitation for people to rush into it and do the sort of thing that Pete and I did. And I think we kind of serve as a kind of negative blueprint for how I think what I think is the appropriate way to think about and then move into and through the Grand Canyon. It's a very special place, and one of the things the Park Service has done incredibly well is to channel most of the visitation that happens at Grand Canyon into a series of corridors in the central part of the canyon. That's where most visitors go. That's where most of your listeners who are familiar with the canyon, who have visited the South Rim, these are the places they have seen. But the backcountry is untrammeled for the moment, and I hope it always remains that way.
Are there places beyond the South Rim that you think would be okay to go, you know, not the backcountry, and still preserve the character of the canyon? South Rim, I think, it's millions of people that come.
There's about 6 million people a year who come to the South Rim and move up to the edge of the rim itself and gaze into the canyon. There's a portion of those who are actually on the North Rim, which is much harder to access. But the majority of those people are on the South Rim itself. And then there's a far smaller number, about 26,000 people, who boat through the canyon each year on commercial rafting trips or private trips. And the number of people who are actually hiking inside the backcountry of the canyon is just a fraction of that. And I think that's appropriate to the landscape because it's hard to overstate just how fragile this environment is. It's a desert landscape, receives obviously very little water in the form of rain or snow melt, and moving through it can have a tremendous impact on the land itself. Particularly, many of your listeners are familiar with this, cryptobiotic soil, this crust, this beautiful crust that forms across the top of soil. Just simply walking across it, the footprints that you will leave, those footprints can remain for decades before the land begins to recover. So these are issues that are very, very important and that really have a profound impact on the backcountry inside Grand Canyon National Park.
Let's take a brief break. When we come back, I do want to talk about creation of the park and development threats, and much else to talk about as well. We're talking with Kevin Fidarko. The latest book is A Walk in the Park, the true story of a spectacular misadventure in the Grand Canyon, and we'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer Kevin Fidarko. The new book, fascinating book, is called A Walk in the Park, the true story of a spectacular misadventure in the Grand Canyon. Kevin Fidarko's friend, the National Geographic photographer Pete McBride, says let's do the 750-mile traverse of Grand Canyon hiking. It'll be a walk in the park. And many, many different meanings to that phrase, right? Before we get into conversation again, Kevin Fidarko, some events coming up. Kevin Fidarko will headline those. Crested Butte, Colorado, Flagstaff, Arizona, Mesa, Arizona, the one I want to highlight, of course, for our listeners. King's English Bookshop, Thursday, May 30th, 6 p.m. And you can go to the King's English Bookshop website to get tickets to that event in Salt Lake City. That's coming up on May 30th. So, Kevin Fidarko, you have a section in the book where you talk about the Havasupai people, the tribe, maybe the most iconic tribe in the Grand Canyon, and the creation of the national park. And you say, as happens in many national parks, Havasupai nor any of the other Native American tribes were consulted. Also, because of pressure from ranchers and miners, etc., not the entirety of the canyon was included in this national park.
Yes, this is a story that really sort of sits at the center not only of Grand Canyon, but of most, if not all, of our national parks. When we, you know, collectively decided as a nation that we were going to identify some of our most beautiful and pristine landscapes and protect them in order to pass them along intact to future generations of Americans. One thing that we that's not really part of the story, it's not really part of the myth that we tell ourselves about our national park system, is that almost all of these landscapes were occupied prior to our arrival. They were home to tribal peoples who had been part of these landscapes for millennia prior to our arrival, and whose connections to these lands ran deeper and affected them in more profound ways than many people who look or sound like you or me can begin to imagine. These people were exiled from and disenfranchised from these landscapes, and then their histories were written out of the stories of our national parks. And this is the case in Grand Canyon. There are 11 Native American tribes whose ancestral lands either abut or lie directly inside of Grand Canyon National Park. And the tribe that you're referring to, the Havasupai, their reservation is actually surrounded by Grand Canyon National Park. And their story is a story that involves being squeezed down to a reservation that was less than 1 square mile until in 1975, as a result of a piece of legislation called the Grand Canyon Expansion Act, they were able to successfully argue for the return of almost a very, very significant amount of land on the south rim of the Grand Canyon that was given back to them, restored to them, and that enabled them to kind of reconnect with a piece of their history that had been stolen from them. And they remain inside of Grand Canyon today and are an integral part of not just the story of that park, but the experience of people who are moving into it and trying to understand it. And this was a big part of the journey that Pete and I undertook as we moved through the Grand Canyon, understanding that this aspect of the landscape, something that's been ignored for too long, it needs to be reintegrated into the way that all of us experience these places.
You met a woman named Dana Ukwala. I'm not sure how to say her last name.
Yes.
Havasupai woman. I just want to quote a couple of quotes from her. It's very powerful. She says, "This is our home that you'll be walking through," right? And she gave you, I think, a bit of tobacco, said to, you know, sprinkle this at various parts. It'll be a protection to you. She goes on to say, "We are real. We're not just a name. We're humans. We're part of this world right here, because this is our home." Then she gave you some advice. She says, "This is a very powerful journey you're on. By the time you've finished, you'll realize something in you has changed. But to really see the canyon, to touch and feel and hear everything about this place, you'll have to pay attention."
Absolutely. What you just quoted, Tom, was an incredibly important step in an arc of learning I'll say growth as well, that Pete and I both underwent over the course of our journey. And Diana Ukwala and a number of other Native Americans from other tribes who we met and encountered along the way were integral to that process. She was speaking specifically in that moment about paying attention to the land, paying attention to physical details, birds and plants, just the way the rock itself moves. But she was also delivering a deeper message, paying attention to the feel of the place itself. And I think the stories that are embedded inside of it, what she was urging us to do was to pay attention and to listen to everything that we heard. And it was a message that only, it took on a new dimension of significance after the trip was over. And I realized that part of my obligation as I sat down to frame the story and put this book together was to build into the story the history of her people and the tribes that that neighbor and lie alongside of her reservation. And so building that story, listening to that story, and integrating it into the story of our own journey to the canyon was my effort to pay heed to the words that she was sharing with us when she encountered us in that moment.
You include a quote from Terry Tempest Williams, it's head of one of the chapters. I'll probably get it wrong. Something to the effect of, "When we discover the desert, we discover ourselves." And it probably applies to any wild place, but especially desert. I wonder what it is about desert. I guess, tests us, I guess. It's extreme. I'm not sure what it is.
I'm not sure either, but you're certainly putting your finger on the essence of it. You know, I spoke a bit about it a moment ago. It has to do with the austerity and the brutality of deserts, the fact that these are not easy places, these are not soft places, these are not green places. They're not places that accommodate us. We must accommodate ourselves to them in order to be able to move through them and survive. And it's that reorientation that I think is an important component of a change that overtakes us as we move into desert landscapes. It requires us to become humble in a way that we are not normally in our everyday lives. We live in a world that we have created and shaped and influenced in ways that deliver to us a message that we matter, that we create a tremendous amount of shock and awe as we go about our business in the world, that we're important, that we are at the center. And every aspect of a desert environment delivers the opposite message. The message it delivers is that we are not important, we do not matter, we're not at the center of things. And if you're inside of Grand Canyon and you're inside of a giant chasm whose sides are framed by mile-high ramparts of rock, stacked rock, 26 different layers of it that extend further back into the past than one can even begin to imagine. If you're inside a chasm whose bottom is a rock whose lineage extends 1.3 billion years into the past, that's about a third the lifespan of the planet itself, you realize how small we are and how little we really matter in the context of all of that rock and all of the time that is distilled within the folds of it. And I think this is what Terry, who's a far better writer than I will ever be able to be, not only put her finger on in that quote, but articulates and celebrates in all of her writing.
You made another woman I want to talk about now, I think a Native American woman, Renee Yellowhorse. And she talks about a danger that's in parts of the park, commercial development, right, tourism development, in this case, a tramway that they're trying to fight, a proposed tramway. And she, I just want to quote her here, your quote in the book. She gets emotional talking about this. She says, "Been more than 2 years, it still gets to me because I know that if that tramway comes through here, it'll dig into the heart of the earth, and I will never be able to come here again and feel the spirits of my family and my ancestors." Very powerful.
So Renee Yellowhorse was talking about a proposed project at the time. This was back in 2016 when we were undertaking the hike, and it was called the Escalade Tramway. And this was a proposal brought to the Navajo Nation by a group of entrepreneurs and developers in Phoenix, Arizona. And their idea was to build a huge entertainment complex and resort on a very remote part of the Navajo reservation at the eastern edge of Grand Canyon. And the centerpiece of that project would be a tramway that would extend from the rim of the canyon all the way down to the bottom of the canyon at a very, very important place, a place that holds tremendous spiritual and religious significance, not just for the Navajo, but for all of the native tribes of the Grand Canyon. This is a point where two rivers come together deep inside Grand Canyon. It's where the turquoise waters of the Little Colorado River, the largest tributary of the Colorado River inside Grand Canyon, meet and merge with the water of the Colorado itself. It's known as the confluence. And the proposal that these developers wanted to do was to anchor the terminus of the tram directly above the confluence. There would be a raised metal walkway along the shore. There would be an amphitheater and then a restaurant directly overlooking the confluence. And this was a project that had some attraction for a number of members of the Navajo Nation for some very legitimate reasons. It would bring economic prosperity and jobs and income to a section of the Navajo Nation that is very isolated and remote and remains poor to this day, economically poor. But there were other members of the nation who felt that this was an insult, not only to the landscape itself, but to the traditions and the culture of the Navajo who revere that part of the canyon. And so the story of this project really is the story of so many development projects in the sense that it created tremendous rifts and fractures within a community of people who are struggling to figure out how to build an economic future for themselves. And this is one reason why Renee Yellowhorse was in tears when she talked about this project and articulated her objections to it as she stood on the east rim of the canyon, pointing Pete and I towards exactly where the confluence was and where the tramway would be located and how she felt about all of that.
I was touched by, or troubled. There's a passage in the same place in the book. You ask her, has the developer made any overtures or any nods or any concessions, at least from their point of view, to cultural concerns that you're expressing? And she said yes, but it seemed woefully inadequate.
It did to her. The developers did make an effort. What they proposed doing was to provide a fenced-off area at the top of the tramway where any member of the Navajo tribe or any other tribe of the canyon could come and offer prayers to the canyon itself. And then if any of them wanted to take a ride on the tramway, they would be allowed to do so for free. And I asked Renee if that was enough, if that mattered to her, and she said no. And I asked her why, and her response was kind of startling. She didn't hesitate for a second. She just barked out. She said, "We're not Pocahontas on the rim." And I think what she was speaking to was the idea that a project like this was designed to encourage people to interact with the canyon in a way that was fundamentally at odds with and inappropriate to the way that not only the Navajo, but most tribes of the canyon see the landscape itself. This is not Disney World for these people. This is not a place that they think about, approach, or enter into with a desire to be entertained or titillated or amused. It's not a place that they go to on vacation. It's a place that sits at the bedrock of their ethos and identity as a people and a culture. And so their orientation to the landscape itself, the way they frame themselves in relation to it, has nothing to do with entertainment. And the idea itself is offensive to them for ways that I think are understandable and deserve to be heard and respected. That's what she was speaking to in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess an illustration that for some projects there can be compromise, a meeting of the minds. Others, maybe the two sides just totally irreconcilable. You just can't have a meeting of the minds. I wonder, this project, proposed project, touches on something, I think, many different motivations for why people come out to these places. And some people just want to go through them, right, and not have it really touch them all that much. It's just, more like bringing up some pictures, I suppose.
I mean, I think that's the way that many of us are encouraged to think about and experience our public lands and our national parks. And I don't really fault any of us for that. It's the way that I myself approach these places as a younger person. We see posters of them, we see advertisements of them, and we think about, we want to go to places like Grand Canyon or Yosemite or Yellowstone or the Everglades, because they look really fun. And the truth is that they are. But I think what we do to ourselves when we fail to make the effort to peel back a few layers and take a deeper look at what each and every one of these places contain and what they have to offer, we deprive ourselves of a much richer experience. You know, by when we it's surprising how little effort and time it takes just to simply familiarize oneself with some of the histories of these places, Grand Canyon being one example. Just knowing a little bit about the history of the Havasupai tribe as you move from the south rim of the Grand Canyon on the Kaibab, the South Kaibab Trail, or the Bright Angel Trail. If you're on the Bright Angel Trail, you're going to encounter a place now known as Havasupai Gardens, an oasis that is directly beneath the rim. Just knowing a little bit about the history of that place and the history of the tribe can enrich and color and deepen one's own experience and enable you to come away from that experience with something much more substantive. And I think that sometimes there's a reluctance among so many of us to peel back those layers, but there are rewards that at the end of that effort, and our relationship with our public lands and our national parks can be strengthened and deepened by doing that. And I think that's part of the message of this book.
Are there current development plans that are developers are trying to go forward with? And I assume natives are fighting. Anything currently planned?
Well, I should mention that the tramway project that we were speaking about a moment ago, that project was defeated in a vote at the Navajo legislature in October of 2017, I believe. And the project was shot down. But, you know, one of the legacies of a proposal like this is that the idea itself never goes away. The prospect of making a great deal of money by leveraging Native American proximity to an iconic national park and convincing a tribe to sign on to a project like this. There's so much money to be made if a project like the tramway could go through that that idea will continue to resurface in the future. It will never really go away. And that's an example of something on the eastern rim of the Grand Canyon. But if you shift your gaze all the way to the west, at the far end of the Grand Canyon, something similar is occurring. There's a tribe on the far western side of the Grand Canyon, the Hualapai tribe, and they have decided, for legitimate reasons, it's important to note, to hitch their wagon to a development model which involves encouraging helicopter tourism in the western part of Grand Canyon. They have partnered with a number of helicopter air tour companies that bring tourists from Las Vegas out to the west rim of the Grand Canyon each and every day, and they are flooding the interior of the canyon with hundreds of helicopter flights, which are incredibly disruptive to the experience of the canyon and to the soundscape in particular. One of the most precious and least appreciated treasures inside of Grand Canyon is its silence and its tranquility, and that treasure is being shattered and destroyed by the noise that these machines are creating each and every day. And yet the Hualapai tribe is able to experience a level of economic prosperity that has never been available to them in the 150-year history of their interaction with our culture. And so this is an example of the very complex set of issues that are being weighed and balanced in each and every one of the development projects that loom over the canyon.
If you just joined us, we're talking with the writer Kevin Fedarko. His latest book is called A Walk in the Park, the subtitle, The True Story of a Spectacular Misadventure in the Grand Canyon. Before we go to break, just to mention several events. The one in Salt Lake City is on Thursday, May 30th. Kevin Fedarko will be there at 6 p.m., King's English Bookshop, and you can go to their website to get tickets for that event. Thursday, May 30th, 6 p.m., Salt Lake City. We'll have more with Kevin Fedarko following this break. Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. We're talking with Kevin Fedarko. His latest book out now is called A Walk in the Park, the true story of a spectacular misadventure in the Grand Canyon. Kevin Fedarko had especially touched, very poignant, you talk about your dad in this book. At a certain point, you and Pete have another leg of this journey to go, but you get word that, your father's prostate cancer has come back, so you have to split up. And you mentioned that your dad is the, you know, the first one took you on your first hikes, right? Taught you to love, I guess, the outdoors. Tell me a little bit about your dad.
Yeah, you're right. He did, but in kind of a strange way, Tom. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a landscape which, you know, your listeners may not be aware, it has really been Western Pennsylvania, where Pittsburgh is located, is a place that was probably one of the most beautiful places on earth before it was industrialized in the latter part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century and became one of the great steel producing centers in the world. And I grew up in a landscape that was defined by the wreckage and the damage that industry like that does to nature. And maybe one of the more concrete examples of that is the fact that my father loved to hike. He loved to get out in nature. And the place that he taught my brother and I to hike was an area located directly behind our grandparents' house in western Pennsylvania, where we would go probably twice a month for Sunday dinner. And it was called the Spilly Piles. And what it was basically a strip mine, a farm that had been where the topsoil had been removed and coal had been mined out. And it was a landscape denuded of vegetation. It was filled with sockets and craters of orange colored water from the runoff. And we hiked through the mining tailings and the Spilly Piles. That's how I learned to walk and to interact with nature. And that's what my father taught me. The other thing he did was he handed me a book when I was about 10 years old. He'd purchased it at a used bookstore. And it was a book called The Man Who Walked Through Time by an author named Colin Fletcher. And it was a story of a hiker who embarked on the first modern recorded hike through Grand Canyon National Park. And the photograph on that cover of a man standing with a backpack on a rocky ledge overlooking this immense abyss of copper-colored rock and turquoise water at the bottom transfixed me and inspired me and implanted the idea in my mind as a small boy that I needed to find a way of moving beyond this ruined landscape of my childhood and touching something that was embodied in the image on the cover of that book.
Yeah, excellent. I want to talk about some dangers you encountered. Anybody who's you know, doing this hike encounters some pretty severe dangers sometimes. One of those flash floods. You desert, of course, we know. Lack of water, except sometimes when you have too much water. You have a little kind of a footnote that was just harrowing even to read about the dangers of flash floods. It's several people over the years killed, right? One man, his name is John McHugh, somehow survived a flash flood. I'll just read this. He emerged from the maelstrom battered, covered in mud, crying brown tears because the force of the water had peeled open his eyelids, forcing silt into the tear ducts, an indication of just the incredible force of a flash flood.
Yeah, and I think, Tom, a testament to the power of nature and how it sculpts a landscape like Grand Canyon. I mean, flash floods are in many ways the architects of Grand Canyon. The Colorado River, we often think of as the thing that has carved the canyon out, but what's really shaped the interior of the canyon are these brief but incredibly violent pulses of water and churning debris created by cloudbursts in the rim country. And as that water is funneled into the narrow fissures that run off the sides of the canyon, it achieves incredible power and force and begins acting like a knife and cutting through the rock, carving out these side canyons and tributary canyons. And if you're unlucky enough to be inside the canyon when one of these events occurred, you can be caught and entrained in one of these debris flows. And most people who are trapped inside of a flash flood fail to survive. It's a terrible experience and a little understood phenomenon that is rarely witnessed. But it's a very, very important part of the world of the interior of the Grand Canyon, and something that one needs to bear in mind as one's moving through it on foot.
Just have a couple minutes left in the conversation. What do you most want people to take away from the book?
You know, what I'd least like them to take away from the book is the idea that these two heroic adventurers battled with and conquered the Grand Canyon, because that's not the point of the story at all. That's the frame of the story, how two bumbling neophytes made their way from one end of the canyon to the other. But the heart and soul of the story are the things that we've been talking about in this conversation, Tom. It's the idea that at the center of this landscape, at the center of this park, at the center of all of our parks, are Native American people who have been ignored and forgotten, and whose stories are important because they have things to say to us as Americans that we as a society need to hear. Things to say about what is important about our landscape, what is important about our country, what is important about the sacrifices that are needed to preserve these places so that they can be handed off intact to future generations of Americans, so that their gifts and their values and their treasures can be contemplated and experienced by our children and our children's children. I think that the stories of the Native American people who are part of our parks is at the heart of those parks, and it's something that we all should embrace.
We've been talking with the writer Kevin Fidarko. The latest book out and available now is called A Walk in the Park, the true story of a spectacular misadventure in the Grand Canyon. You can find him as well at kevinfidarko.com. And he'll be at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City on Thursday, May 30th, 6 p.m. You can get your tickets at the King's English Bookshop website, or you can go to kevinfidarko.com and get your tickets there as well. Kevin Fidarko, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Tom, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we'll go out, as we do on Wednesdays, with the Beehive Archive. Thanks, everyone.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Weiss. Potato-growing clubs became all the rage in the early 20th century as interest in a formal agricultural education grew. Learn more after this.
I'm Jody Graham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities, with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. Agricultural work is critical to rural Utah's history, but it wasn't until the Utah State Agricultural College, known as USAC, was established in 1888 that young people had access to a formal education in farming. Getting students interested in husbandry required a little creativity, but Professor James C. Hogginson was up for the challenge. The answer? Potato growing clubs. When Hogginson joined the faculty of USAC in 1907, the college was focused primarily on providing future farmers with college-level education. But in 1912, he was assigned on an outreach program aimed at promoting agricultural and home science education. Working with local school officials, Hogginson visited 58 schools and talked with nearly 7,000 boys. His enthusiasm was contagious. Boys' potato-growing clubs sprouted up in counties throughout the state, with roughly 600 members in Cache County and 300 in Box Elder County. Boys also joined programs in Utah and San Pete counties, marking the beginning of Utah's 4-H youth clubs. Goals for the boys in Utah's potato growing clubs were ambitious. Each participant pledged to grow a half acre of potatoes, and members were expected to keep meticulous records of their crops. Students were encouraged to compete for local prizes at county fairs, or even enter the annual state fair. Young farmers were judged on their yields, best 50 pounds and best tubers. Of course, points were deducted for small and unsightly potatoes. Each entry was accompanied by a written paper detailing how their crop had been grown. In 1913, Cache County resident and Potato Club member, 16-year-old Merle Gilbert Heyer, won first place and $100 at the Utah State Fair. Within just a few years, agricultural clubs expanded beyond potato growing. Under the Extension Division of USAC, clubs expanded to corn, apples, poultry, sugar beets, as well as homemaking activities such as flower gardening and sewing that focused on girls. Club work encouraged education and excitement around agriculture and home economics. The program made meaningful changes to methods of farming, seed selection, crop variety, and record keeping of crops. Today, 4-H clubs have expanded beyond growing potatoes, but they continue to empower young learners through hands-on learning opportunities. Find sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of Utah Humanities, I'm Megan Weiss.